From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, former President Jimmy Carter on religion and politics. He's written a new book called Living Faith. Also, a biracial daughter confronts her mother with the big question, why did the mother give the daughter away to an African-American couple to bring up? The daughter, June Cross, now a producer on the PBS Frontline series, has produced a Frontline documentary about her mother's decision and its repercussions. Commentator Milo Miles reviews new South of the Border pop by the band Jaguares, and writer Julie Showalter remembers growing up on a turkey farm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Officials at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo say an American soldier who has been held in North Korea on spy charges since August will be released Tuesday. Evan Hunziker's father, Edwin, in Tacoma, Washington, says he's not getting his hopes up yet, though.
Until he gets on the ground in Tokyo, that's when I'll be able to know that he's on his way home. There's no done deal until a fat lady sings, you know. What can I tell you?
The announcement of the impending release comes as Democratic Congressman Bill Richardson of New Mexico arrived in North Korea to try to negotiate Hunziker's freedom. Hunziker was arrested after he entered North Korea from China. He was accused of spying for South Korea, a charge that officials in both Washington and Seoul deny. Search teams in the waters off the Comoros Islands are trying to retrieve bodies and wreckage from Saturday's crash of an Ethiopian Airlines jet that went down after running out of fuel following a hijacking. More than 100 people are presumed dead. At least 48 people survived the crash. The BBC's Martin Dawes has more.
At first light, the island authorities started work to drag the central fuselage 100 yards to the shore. It now lies beached, upside down. Although some bodies have been taken out, others remain, still strapped in their seats. The grisly recovery work is likely to continue for some time. The next task will be to lift off the tail section from the reef a quarter of a mile out to sea. It's thought that most of the people still unaccounted for will be found in the three broken sections of the airliner. The survivors have left the islands. The lightly injured were flown out last night in an Ethiopian Boeing 767, similar to the one whose wreckage is being recovered.
The BBC's Martin Dawes. The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Columbia are preparing to retrieve a satellite. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Mission Control was thinking about cutting the mission of Wake Shield short by almost a day. The concern was over a possible close encounter between Wake Shield and the second satellite the Columbia astronauts released last week. That second satellite is a 4-ton robot observatory called Orpheus SPOS. Orpheus uses jet thrusters on automatic pilot to help aim its telescopes. Mission scientists were worried that even if Orpheus didn't smack into Wake Shield, its jet exhaust might contaminate the super clean vacuum where the 2-ton silver disk is working. A clean environment is critical as Wake Shield creates high-quality semiconductors. Since the danger has been dismissed, the astronauts will leave the 12-foot-wide disk alone until tonight. That's when astronaut Tom Jones is scheduled to pluck Wake Shield out of the sky with the shuttle's robot arm. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 33 points at 6,505 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 4. This is NPR News. Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations says Baghdad has agreed to all UN conditions that have held up implementation of an oil-for-food deal. One of the obstacles had been Iraqi insistence on controlling the observers who will monitor the arrangements. More than 20,000 students marched through Belgrade today to protest court rulings that erased an apparent opposition electoral victory. It was the biggest student demonstration against Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic in 4 years. The courts involved in annulling the vote are widely thought to be controlled by Milosevic. A gathering of the nation's governors, Republican governors, is continuing in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and on the agenda today is plotting legislative strategy with GOP congressional leaders. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Michigan Governor John Engler is the outgoing chair of the Republican Governors Association. Over the weekend, he said they'll continue to call for less taxation and a balanced budget amendment. Engler also says states will push for control over Medicaid dollars. saying states can better implement such a program. Republican governors are still trying to figure out exactly what message voters sent in this year's elections. In addition to President Clinton's easy win, Democrats made gains in state legislatures around the country, but the GOP held onto the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House, though by a smaller margin. Today, House Speaker Newt Gingrich and Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott will meet with the governors. They're expected to discuss ways to get things done this session by taking a cooperative approach with Democrats in Congress and the White House. This is Don Gagne reporting.
North Carolina-based Duke Power has announced it's buying Pan Energy Corporation for $7.7 billion in stock. Duke Power now serves nearly 2 million customers in the Carolinas. Pan Energy is based in Houston and is the third largest natural gas marketer in the country. The deal is the latest in a wave of consolidation in the utility industry, electric and natural gas companies working to offer one-stop energy shopping for customers. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jimmy Carter knows that as a born-again Christian president, his faith was the subject of public speculation. He writes about his faith and how it sustained him while he was president in a new collection of essays called Living Faith. He says the book is an outgrowth of the Bible classes he's been teaching ever since he became an adult. He now leads an adult class at a Baptist church in Plains, Georgia. He writes that it's become increasingly difficult to separate church and state issues, and even the purely religious issues have to be addressed by politicians. Jimmy Carter says that since leaving the White House in 1980, he's moved away from politics and toward religion. I asked him to elaborate on that.
Well, I've got more time now to devote to my church and my duties as a Christian in a non-political fashion. I just don't have any ambitions or interest in ever seeking another public office. And the Carter Center's work, in which Rosa and I devote almost all of our time, is strictly bipartisan in nature. So now I'm able to teach Sunday school every Sunday that I'm in Plains, which is about 2 out of 3 Sundays. Last year I taught 36 times. And some other aspects of our life are directly related to Christianity. But I don't want to imply that when I was president that I abandoned my faith or found a basic inconsistency between what I believe in religion and what I did as a politician. I think almost always they were compatible. There were a few times when they were not completely compatible, but I took an oath of office before God to support the Constitution and laws of my nation, and I did. And if I disagreed with some of the laws or felt that they were not completely compatible with my religious faith, I just obeyed the law.
That's an interesting way to look at it, though, that you took an oath before God to actually serve the country. And so you felt that you had it straight with your religion, that you were in this office to serve the country, and it wasn't about your personal religious convictions when it came down to certain issues. It was about what you thought was best for the country or in the majority interest.
Two or three aspects. One is that I believe in the separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very careful not to have religious services in the White House or to have religious meetings in the White House. I went to church on Sunday when I was in Washington at the First Baptist Church at Camp David. We had a private religious service. And there were very few times when I felt any discrepancy at all. But I had to interpret the Constitution as the Supreme Court ruled it to be at that particular moment. There were two issues, for instance, I'll just give an example, where I felt that, I just couldn't believe that Jesus Christ would favor abortions. And I also can't believe that he would favor the death penalty. And fortunately, all the time I was governor, all the time I was president, there was never a death penalty imposed. On abortion, the Supreme Court had ruled the Roe versus Wade was applicable, and I obviously, as president, enforced that interpretation of the Constitution, but I did everything I could to reduce the need for abortions. So that was the main thing that came to mind.
While you were in the White House and while you were campaigning for president, did you feel that a lot of Americans misunderstood or misinterpreted what it meant to you to be born again?
Well, that was obvious to me because the number one news story of the entire 1976 campaign was an interview that I gave with Playboy magazine. And all I did was quote part of the Sermon on the Mount, and it became an issue that almost cost me the election. The Playboy interviewer turned off his tape recorder, started to leave my home, and he said, "You claim to be a born-again Christian. You claim to be perfect. American citizens imperfect. How can you claim to be willing to govern them fairly?" And I said, "Well, you've completely misinterpreted my religion. Our religion teaches us that all of us have sinned, come short of the glory of God, that we should not judge other people. And Jesus taught us not to try to distinguish between degrees of sinfulness. If we hate our brother, we should not criticize someone who commits murder. If we have lust in our heart for a woman, we should not criticize a person who commits adultery." And, of course, the next question was inevitable. He said, "Have you committed adultery?" And I answered that question. He said, "Well, have you ever had lust in your heart?" And I said, "Sure. When I was a high school kid, when I was in college, before I married Rosen, quite often I would look at a beautiful girl and I would want to have sex with her." And he said, "Well, thanks a lot." So he left. And two or three weeks later, Playboy magazine came out. It was the biggest selling issue of Playboy in history. And my public opinion poll dropped 15% in 10 days. So that was those innocent days 20 years ago, just because I said that I, you know, had lust, as I thought every man did. But then the news reporters went all over the country asking famous preachers and TV evangelists about the issue, and they all said, no, I've never lusted after any woman except my wife. So it made me look, you know, both sinful and also, I would guess, equivocating on an important issue.
Your years in the White House coincided with the emergence of the religious right. Did you have many encounters with the religious right?
No, in fact, I never heard of the moral majority of the religious right until the latter stages of my campaign in 1976. They were not well known. And then it was only a couple of years after that, I believe, that Jerry Falwell, for instance, was on the front cover of Time magazine with the startling emergence of the religious right. And by the time I went out of office, they had become quite a formidable political entity. They had basically gone to bed with the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And since then, of course, they've had waxing and waning influence on the global or the American political scene. So I didn't have any unpleasant encounters with them during my campaign, but after I got to be president, I was looked upon by some of them as a non-Christian. In fact, one of the most exalted members in the Baptist faith came to the Oval Office one day, I think in 1979, with his wife. I met him. I was very proud to meet the leader of my denomination. And when he left, he said, "Mr. President, we'll be praying that you abandon secular humanism as your faith and return to Christianity." I had no idea what he was talking about. And I asked a few of my friends who were theologians and experts on religion, and they tried to explain what he was talking about. The measure then was whether or not I was in favor of mandatory prayer in schools, or whether or not I was in favor of a constitutional amendment to prohibit all abortions, whether or not I was in favor of other things of that kind. One of the things they were against then was my negotiating with the Soviet Union to have a strategic arms limitation agreement. They looked upon the Panama Canal treaties as proof that I didn't measure up to their standards of Christianity, things of that kind.
Jimmy Carter is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays about faith called Living Faith. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jimmy Carter. He has a new collection of essays about faith called Living Faith. How did you approach your prayer life in the White House? You say in your book that other presidents have brought in Billy Graham to organize worship for them, but you didn't want to do that in the White House. You thought it violated your sense of separation of church and state. So what did you do?
Well, I worshiped as I would if I had not been in public life at all. I went to Sunday services at the First Baptist Church in Washington, which was the nearest Baptist church to the White House. Most of the weekends we tried to go to Camp David. We had a chaplain from a nearby Army base come and preach a sermon. We sang hymns together. And as far as my personal prayer life was concerned, I would say it was much more frequent and maybe on the average more heartfelt than ever, any other time in my life, because I felt that the decisions I made were affecting the lives of hundreds of millions of people. I never prayed for popularity. I never prayed to be reelected, things of that kind. I prayed that I could keep my nation at peace. I prayed that I could extend the advantages of peace to other people, say, between Egypt and Israel at Camp David. When the hostage crisis came along, the prayer that I made was that all the hostages would come back home safe and free, that I would not betray the principles of my nation or do anything to embarrass it. And I think in all those cases, my prayers were answered. I think God always answers our prayers. Quite often, God's answer is no. We don't get what we ask for. And then the obligation, if we have faith, is to find out within ourselves why. Are we asking for selfish things? Are we asking for things that are unjustified? Are we asking for things that ought to be granted in the future? Should we change the priorities in our lives? Are our prayers in accordance with God's will? Those are the kind of things that I've learned over a long lifetime, as you know. And those are the things I try to describe in Living Faith.
What was your sense of prayer when you were a child, and how has your sense of prayer changed as an adult?
Well, when I was a child, say when I reached the age of 10 or teenage life, I had some very serious doubts about what I heard in church, what I heard in Sunday school, what I heard my own father teaching. But I wouldn't express my doubts to anybody. And I thought I was very sinful not to have absolute and total faith. Now my faith is stronger. I can see the various aspects of a deep Christian faith. I realize that as I was at the age of 15, I'm still searching. I'm still trying to learn. I'm still trying to stretch my heart, stretch my mind. I learned two or three times in my life that my faith could sustain total doubt in God. I rejected God a few times. I felt that God had betrayed me, that I could not depend on my faith at all. And I had to go through a very difficult and unpleasant healing process. I've learned over a period of a long lifetime, 50 years of marriage with Rosalind, how sadly mistaken I was in dealing with her. When we first got married, I was an arrogant young Naval Academy graduate. Rosen was a very shy, timid, younger person from Plains, Georgia. I totally dominated her. I didn't show any sensitivity when she was distressed. I was just impatient. When decisions were to be made about our family's life, I didn't consult with her. I just made a decision and informed her what we were going to do. And that was in my formative stage as a mature human being. I've learned to correct some of those mistakes. So prayer life for me has paralleled in awareness and growth and in significant my evolution as a human being. And I hope that I'll continue to improve in the remaining years that I have.
Tell me if this is too personal, okay? What were the times in your life that you thought God betrayed you?
Well, one of the most distressing times was in 1966. I had been a state senator 2 terms. I thought after prayer that I should run for governor of Georgia. I mounted a massive campaign all over the state, frantically, shaking hands, asking people to support me. My opponent was a racist named Lester Maddox, whose symbol was a pick handle that he used to beat African Americans over the head if they tried to come into his restaurant and buy some fried chicken. When the results came in, Lester Maddox had won, and I had lost. And I couldn't believe that the Georgia people preferred him. I couldn't believe that God would let this happen. So I had a complete renunciation of my faith. And my sister, who lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Ruth Carter Stapleton, was a very famous evangelist. My mother called her and told her that I was had this attitude. So Ruth came down to Plains, and we went out in the woods. And Ruth tried to console me, which was impossible. And Ruth quoted a couple of verses from the second chapter of James, which was a foundation of Ruth's ministry, which is a very happy ministry. Anyway, James says, according to God, that no matter how horrible a mistake we made, or how total our failure might be, or how abject our despair, or how great our loss, that if we have, first of all, courage, and then if we have patience, and then if we are wise enough to seek wisdom from God, any catastrophe can be changed into a blessing. I told Ruth that this was a complete baloney. That wasn't the word I used. That it was ridiculous. And Ruth said, Jimmy, you have to have faith that this is true. She said, why don't you just forget about politics for a while and just respond to any opportunities you have. So just a few weeks later, I was asked to go as a lay witness to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, a group of volunteer Baptists from State College, which is where Penn State University is, had called every family in the phone book, and they had identified 100 families, none of whom had any religious faith. And I was asked to go and visit those families. So I knocked on the door. Some received us with open arms, some wouldn't open the door. And at the end of a week, I had experienced for the first time in my life a genuine presence of God, a sense that the Holy Spirit was with us. We had 48 people who accepted the Christian faith. We rented an old church building and left Lock Haven with a new church going. And that was a turning point in my life. I then began to see that no matter if I was elected to any future office or not, that there were other things in life. As the history books would say, I ran for governor again. I was elected. I went on and became president of the United States. But that's not the real point. The point is that when we do have a setback in politics or in business or whatever, we need to have faith that we can find an alternative that would give us much more significant priorities in life.
How do you think the issue of religion in the lives of public figures has changed from the years you were in the White House to now?
Well, there's no doubt that in many elections just settled in the United States this November, that the role of religion has played a major part. And now there is a blatant condemnation of any candidate who espouses any degree of abortion, a blatant condemnation of candidates who are not in favor of mandatory prayer in schools, or who condone any equal rights for homosexuals, for gays. And these are litmus tests for a candidate. If a candidate measures up to all those litmus tests and others, I would say the death penalty is another one, or the freedom of ownership of guns, They vary, of course, but those are a few that come to mind. Those are the measurements of a candidate who's acceptable among the very conservative religious organizations. So this is a new development in our country. I don't think this has ever happened before 1980, but since then it's become quite a prevalent factor on the American political scene.
Jimmy Carter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called Living Faith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, producers of the 4-CD box set In Their Own Voices, A Century of Recorded Poetry, an anthology of significant poets of our time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with a white mother who gave up her half-black child in the 1950s, and we talk with the now-grown child. Also, new Mexican pop music from the band Jaguares, and writer Julie Showalter tells us about growing up on a turkey farm. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Spanish-speaking pop has been building audiences in America for years, starting with more traditional crossover performers like Gloria Estefan, up through MTV Latino, and the fallen star Selena. Commentator Milo Miles identifies the next step as the breakthrough of rock en español, the boisterous, eclectic sound promoted by young bands all over Latin America. Milo says the frontrunner of the movement has to be Jaguares from Mexico. The band played its New York debut last month, and Milo was there to see Latin rock pick up momentum.
Hernandez inspires believers. As the singer and songwriter of the group Jaguares, he's new. But as the frontman of the band Caifanes, he's been a major celebrity in Mexico throughout the 90s. The crowd and the performance I saw at the Roxy in New York made it easy to understand why. Blessed with feline good looks and long, graceful, tattooed limbs, Hernandez also possesses the rock god gene that allows his personality to fill stadiums at home. But it was important to see if he and his group could win one on the road. Of course, the audience was largely converted already. How often do you see people in a mosh pit wearing jaguar masks? In his songwriting, Hernandez works at the intersection of magical realism and punk. He's a dreamer and a lover of outsized passions. In one song, he offers to leave his skin and innards on a girlfriend's wall before he flies to exile in a barren land. Yet he flips off the police and boasts of hanging on street corners with the toughs. Since his voice is both silvery and sinewy, Hernandez glides through every role. At the Roxy show, he gathered hugs and kisses from both guys in torn t-shirts and gals in unbuttoned blouses. Hernandez can also square circles with music. The band Caifanes is no more because the break between Hernandez and the inventive lead guitarist Alejandro Markovich degenerated into a legal battle over the name. The Jaguares guitarist is Jose Aguilera. While he was looser at the Roxy than on the debut album El Equilibrio de los Jaguares, his earthbound solos confirm he is designated as an excellent role player, not competition for the spotlight. Hernandez has fortunately kept the burly but flexible Caifanes rhythm section. With this help, Hernandez is able to combine the moody, sharp-edged melodies of one of his idols, Robert Smith of The Cure, with the dense, heavy riffing arrangements of another inspiration, King Crimson. Yet whether they play space jams or angry anti-Valentines, Jaguares are more warm-hearted and uplifting than either of those English outfits. When a delirious fan waving the Mexican flag threw it up to Hernandez at the Roxy show, the singer sang a whole song with the banner draped around his shoulders. That takes loads of confidence and a sure bond with the crowd. Hernandez then draped his national symbol over the microphone stand where it stayed for most of the nearly two-hour concert. It seemed appropriate and thoroughly earned. Even if nothing is sure but death and Whitney Houston, Saul Hernandez is shooting for the top with the pop music force of a whole country behind him.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. Coming up, A Secret Daughter. This is Fresh Air. The next edition of the PBS series Frontline, called Secret Daughter, tells the story of one of its own producer's family tree. June Cross is the biracial daughter of a white woman named Norma Storch and an African-American man named Jimmy Cross, who was half of the comedy and music team Stump and Stumpy. June's parents never married. In fact, after their relationship broke up in the late 50s when June was about 5, June's mother gave her away to be raised by an African-American couple in Atlantic City. On her Frontline documentary, June confronts her mother with questions that have always plagued her. The mother also has some questions for June.
When did you ever see yourself as black? When did that first realization come? Because you were with me until you were almost 5 and brought up in an entirely white world. Had no restrictions on you whatsoever. We were living in a beautiful apartment. We had plenty of money.
Well, let's see. I don't know, there's a number of memories that get mushed together. Well, the memorable time that this is kind of frozen in my memory is one time when we were taking a bubble
bath. Once when I was about 7 or 8, I was visiting my mother and we were taking a bubble bath. She looked at me and said that if I had not grown darker as I grew older, I could have stayed with her. That moment is frozen in time. My mother's bamboo-colored skin, my toffee-colored hand, her straight auburn hair, my tight black curls, the white bubbles falling in my eyes.
June Cross spent her childhood shuttling back and forth between two different worlds. For most of the year, she lived with the African-American couple who brought her up, Peggy and Paul Bush. But she spent her summers in California with her mother and her mother's husband, the actor Larry Storch, best known for his role in F Troop. I spoke with June Cross and her mother, Norma Storch. I asked June about the difference between those two worlds.
I don't think I looked at it as black and white when I was growing up. It was my mother's house and Peggy's house, and Mom was just much more, I felt much more free-spirited when I was with my mom. She'd always been a lot, probably Peggy would have said I was too, I wasn't disciplined enough, you know. So Peggy wanted to kind of heel me in and bring me, you know, put me on a structure, and you know, there was a schedule that I was supposed to, you know, get up at a certain time, go to bed at a certain time, eat 3 meals a day, and you know, look just so. And Mom was much more. It was a much looser environment, you know. So I kind of going to see Mom was like playtime. I kind of likened it to being a joint custody child. You know, I get to go see Daddy. You know, when some joint custody children kind of talk about their fathers always giving them whatever they want, and you know, so going to see Mom was like that. You know, And but then, you know, Peggy's house was where I lived and grew up and went to school. And, you know, so all of the structure and things that children, you know, as I've gotten older, realize children really do need, I got from her. And then the kind of encouragement and a broadening of mind that I could not have gotten in the Black community in Atlantic City, I got from Mom and Larry. And they also, it wasn't just school holidays. Mom would write me letters and postcards like two or three. Sometimes I'd get two or three a day. And she called me fairly often. I would go, you know, if they were anywhere nearby and I was within, you know, a traveling distance, I'd go see them. So it wasn't, you know, just holidays or vacations. It was a much more fluid arrangement. And Peggy and Norma had a wonderful correspondence that I was able to get hold of once Peggy died. It was just, I mean, the record of the letters that passed between them on how to raise me, it was really remarkable. I really was a joint project. You know, Peggy would describe to Mom problems she was having with, you know, raising me or, you know, what she wanted me to wear or whatever. And Norma would write back, well, I think you should do this or maybe we should do that. And what do you think about this? And so it really was I was a shared vision from both of them.
Norma, what were some of your fears as a white woman with a daughter who is half African-American, born outside of marriage? What were your concerns for her, and what were your concerns for yourself?
Well, it seems like both of us were at an absolute dead end. I mean, things were getting worse with June, with people, you know, turning around and looking at us on the street or making remarks, things of that sort. And as far as I was concerned, the relationships that I'd been involved with, both of them were terminated when they found out that I had a Black daughter. It's very hard to get, you know, a guy to understand this when you have a Black child. I was living in two different worlds, and I couldn't ever see at that time that I'd be able to put the two of them together. I mean, when I put June with Peggy, which was a Black family, to raise her, she was a little flower, and she blossomed in this milieu. I think if she had been with me, she would have had so many more problems. We would have been segregated. I'm sure she would have hated it as time went on, and so would I. It just was problems.
June, do you agree with that? And do you think of yourself as a flower that blossomed when you went to live with the couple who adopted you?
Yeah, I think I was still a bud even before I left to go live with them.
Well, they didn't adopt her.
They didn't adopt her.
No.
No, well, I went to live. Yeah, I understand what you meant. I'm sorry. I used so many words for what happened here. I went to live with Peggy and Paul. Yeah, I remember that there was a petition in the building where we lived in New York to kick us out because a white woman living with a Black child offended some sense of moral standards that these other people in the building had. And I remember one guy slammed the front door on my hand one time, said he wasn't going to... I had asked him to hold the door open because it was too heavy for me. And, you know, he said he wasn't going to hold the door for any damn nigger. And I was like 4 years old or something like that. And so, I mean, I could see where, you know, Mom just felt that it wasn't going to get any better. I mean, you know, who knew there was going to be a civil rights movement in 1958? You know, I mean, it hadn't happened yet. And she delivered me to a family that was, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, probably, you know, more highly educated than the one she came from. You know, it was certainly, you know, Peggy was a very educated woman, and, you know, the Gregory family that I came to know through them, who I adopted as kind of my play cousins and aunts and uncles, were like third and fourth Harvard educated folks. So I do think she did the best thing in the final analysis.
June, you ask your mother a question that I imagine was very hard to ask, and I'm thinking of the question, well, why didn't you just abort me when you got pregnant? Mm-hmm. Was it hard to ask that? Is that something you had wanted to ask for a long time?
Yeah, I think so. It's probably somewhere in the back of my mind. Although, you know, I mean, a lot of people have asked me about this because of the answer that Mom gives me in the film. But, you know, I say, well, you know, if I had been aborted, I wouldn't be here, so it's a... it's a hard. I didn't feel any particular pain upon hearing the answer back that it was a problem. You know, that she didn't have enough money. Therefore, I'm here.
She didn't have enough money for an abortion.
To ask it. Right. It was probably harder just to ask it, because I guess I think if it was that hard a problem to try to figure out how to raise me, then that I think that was where the, you know, well, why not just, like, solve the problem before it ever got started, you know? But it was, I didn't understand what the money problems were at that time in her life.
Norma, was it hard to be asked that question? Is that a question you never wanted to be asked?
No, because a lot of couples, you know, mixed couples have children that come out that are white. I mean, you know, I really hoped that June would be white, and she was white when she was born anyway. I mean, she was gorgeous. I thought, oh, this is fantastic. You know, I'll be able to keep her with me all the time. It's wonderful.
I'm still gorgeous.
But as Peggy said,
yeah, June, how do you feel about that? You were gorgeous when you were white. I don't think, Norma, that's not what you really meant to say, though, is it?
Well, I meant when I held this little baby in my arms, instead of a black child, it was a white child. So that was the thing that I didn't anticipate any problems coming up.
Right. And so I guess June got darker as she got older.
Yes.
Yeah.
Norma, when June would spend vacations or you know, summers with you, you told friends that she was an adopted daughter, not your birth daughter. Why were you worried about friends finding out the truth? What did you think would happen?
Well, I always handled, after I married Larry, I handled his career. All the business end of it was dependent on me, and I felt that people would not respect me if they knew what the truth was, because they just wouldn't. And I hid that because I had to have authority with Larry's agents and his managers and people he was working with, and to put him where we wanted him to go career-wise. And I always felt that if they knew the truth about me, I would have been a laughingstock or, you know, something or other.
Have you ever had any regrets about your decision to give June to another couple, or do you feel, looking back, that you really did the right thing?
I think I would do the same thing today, knowing what I know if the times were the same and my situation were the same. I mean, I can't see that I would change it. I cried myself to sleep every night. I loved her. I got shingles. I got sick. I mean, giving her up was the most difficult thing I ever did, but it was for her good and ultimately my good also.
June?
Yeah?
Final thoughts on that?
Final thoughts? One of the larger reasons I wanted to do this doc was because I think that a lot of blacks and a lot of whites in this country are related by blood in ways that they don't like to think about. Or won't admit. Whites are ashamed to admit it, and blacks feel it's politically incorrect to admit it. And one of the things I'm hoping comes out of this is maybe we can start a discussion about how we really are part of the same family and not just neighbors living on different divides of the fence.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
June Cross's frontline documentary, Secret Daughter, will be shown tomorrow night on most PBS stations. This is Fresh Air. The big topic of conversation I overheard on the bus this morning was, of course, about Thanksgiving. It seemed no one on this bus liked turkey, but they were each dutifully preparing to cook it or eat it this Thursday. Even vegetarians end up thinking about turkey on Thanksgiving. But none of us have turkey stories as powerful as Julie Schulwalter's. She grew up on a turkey farm. The story she's going to tell us was produced for the public radio series This American Life. It's from their next edition, which is titled Poultry Slam.
The day before the night 3,000 turkeys died, we moved 13,000 turkeys to the range. This requires some explanation. Turkeys spend their first 16 weeks in a heated brooder house. Then they are put outside to range in fenced enclosures. Usually men in trucks come and take them to the range at night. This time, Daddy decided we'd herd them ourselves. It looked simple enough. We made a temporary chute of wire fencing that ran from the double-end doors of the brooder house 50 yards to the pen. We would get behind the turkeys in the brooder house, shout, wave old shirts and gunny sacks at them, and they would run out the doors, through the chute, and into the pen. And that's the way it worked in the first brooder house. The first turkeys hesitated at the door, walked out cautiously, then moved through the chute and dispersed. The rest followed. It took about an hour. Daddy was pleased. "Let's work straight through," he said. "We'll be done by 10. By the time turkeys have been in a brooder house for 16 weeks, the air is filled with ammonia, feather particles, and dust. The stench is overwhelming. After an hour in the brooder house, your lungs hurt for a day. You can contract disabling lung diseases from working only a week in a poultry house. Tiny barbed pieces of feather dig into the tissue of your lung and never let go. But we didn't know that then. We moved the temporary fence to the doors of the second brooder house. When we threw open the doors at the end of the second house, it was 9 a.m. The sun streamed in the open doors on turkeys that had never seen direct sunlight. The one thing you can count on with turkeys is that you never know how they are going to react. I've seen turkeys clamor against a fence trying to get into a range fire. I've seen them rush toward a screaming child trying to kill it, and I've seen them run from a screaming child, spooked and terrified. These turkeys didn't want to go into the sun. As we pushed from behind, they compacted. It was like an old adventure movie where the walls are closing in, but there was no wall at the end, only a patch of sunlight which the turkeys would not touch. We yelled louder, waved our cloths, kicked at the ones in the rear. Finally, Daddy walked through the solid carpet of turkeys to break the logjam at the front. He stood at the edge of the sunlight, lifting the turkeys 3 or 4 at a time with his feet, stirring them with his legs, forcing them into the sun. Suddenly, they broke free. As stubbornly as they had refused to go into the light, they now rushed toward it. They ran in a panic, piling on top of each other, knocking down the temporary fence. By the time Daddy could get the doors closed, at least 1,000 turkeys had escaped and were running free on the farm, onto our neighbor's farm, into the road. We didn't own the turkeys. We raised them for a company that owned the hatchery, the feed mill, the fleet of trucks that delivered and loaded the turkeys, the processing plant. We got a portion of the profits, if there were profits. With 1,000 turkeys gone, there would be no profits on this flock. 16 weeks of Daddy working 14-hour days, of my sisters and me working alongside him anytime we weren't in school, all for no pay. And if we weren't paid for this flock, we would have no cash coming in until the next flock was raised. It took us 8 hours to round up the escaped turkeys, 4 of us trying to track down 1,000 birds that had the whole world in which to hide and run from us. The sun beat down and the air was thick and humid. We stopped once for water, and my sister Billy, the youngest of us, just 11, vomited from the cold water hitting her stomach after hours of sun, heat, and dehydration. As she lay on the ground, shaking and holding her stomach, I hated her for being the one too sick to continue. But even she was not too sick. We all went on. She got an extra 5 minutes to rest, but we all went on. You may be asking right now how my father could be so cruel, how he could work young girls like that. Or you may think I'm exaggerating, that self-pity has magnified our distress. I tell you, this is no exaggeration. And I tell you, my father had no choice. Or any choice he had was so far in the past that there was no unraveling it. Years later, when we were grown, we caught a glimpse of his guilt, his bitterness over what he had done to us. "I couldn't afford niggers," he told my sister Billy, "so I had daughters." At 6 o'clock, we rebuilt the chute. We opened the doors, and the 6,000 remaining turkeys, the sun now low behind them, walked through to the pen. We cleaned up, we ate supper, and we went to bed. That's the day we had before the night 3,000 turkeys died. At midnight, Mother woke us up. "We have to get to the pen. Daddy needs us." We had been too exhausted to hear the storm. We ran out in the driving rain. Flashes of lightning showed Daddy picking up turkeys and throwing them, one after the other. When people learn I grew up on a turkey farm, they invariably ask, "Is it true? Are they really so stupid that they open their mouths in the rain, look up at the sky, and drown?" The answer is yes. Some of them do that. They are that stupid. But that's not how 3,000 die in one night. They die because they are scared, and they huddle together in their fear. They climb on top of each other, trying to get close, to find protection in the mass of bodies, and they suffocate. We called it piling. It wasn't unusual for a loud noise to cause a pile in the brooder house. If there wasn't someone to pull them off each other, 50 could die because someone slammed a door. But this was worse than any pile we'd seen. Turkeys who'd never spent a night outdoors, panicked by thunder and lightning and rain in sheets. All we could do was pull them out of the pile and throw them away from it. They would run back, still seeking the comfort of the group. After a while, standing in mud, grabbing soaked turkeys, throwing them, grabbing some more, you don't know if the ones you were throwing are dead or alive. You don't care. Maybe we saved some. The next day, the sky was cloudless and the sun bore down on us again. We picked up dead turkeys, throwing them onto the back of a flatbed truck. Daddy drove the truck into a field far from the house. 3,000 dead turkeys sitting in the Missouri sun for 2 days. The company that owned the turkeys had them insured against acts of God, so we couldn't do anything until the insurance inspector had seen them. He came, a man from town in a white shirt and tie who held his handkerchief over his face when he got close to the truck. He made no pretense of counting, just stood there, gagging. After he left, Daddy shoveled the turkeys into Dead Turkey Gulch. He poured gasoline on them and struck a match. They burned for days.
Julie Showalter is a writer living in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Her story was produced for the public radio series This American Life and is featured in this week's edition titled Poultry Slam. Our thanks to WBEZ in Chicago, which produces This American Life, associate producer Peter Clowney, and Ira Glass, the show's producer and host. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former Israeli President Chaim Herzog reflects on the turning points of his country's history and his own contributions to his country's development. His father was Israel's chief rabbi. Join us for the next Fresh Air.